Welcome to episode 18 of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. It's been a busy week here, undertaking photo shoots, kit testing, and yet more location scouting, and with the weather hotting up, I'm getting more and more inspired to get out and about to produce more of my new portfolio work too. In the next few days, I'll be putting together some of the behind-the-scenes video that we've made along the way, so do keep an eye out for all updates through the usual social media channels. Now, it's the Easter holidays over here in the UK, so on this week's show, I'd like to suggest somewhere that you might like to visit. Dimbola Lodge on the Isle of Wight, just off the south coast, was the one-time home of pioneering photographer Julia Margaret Cameron. It's now a fascinating museum and well worth a trip if you're in the area. I caught up with Colin Ford, Vice President of the Trust, to delve a little deeper into Julia's history, her work, and why Dimbola is such an important landmark in photography's past, present, and future. So welcome, one and all, to The Active Photographer, episode 18. Okay, so today I'm with Colin Ford at Dimbola Lodge. And Colin, your official sort of capacity here today
I think I'm now called the Vice President of the Trust, but I was certainly one of those who was instrumental in saving the house from being knocked down, basically, and developed as a block of flats. And it's important because this end of the Isle of Wight, quite extraordinarily, in the second half of the 19th century, anybody who was anybody in British life, whether it was cultural life, political life, scientific life, artistic life, they came to this end of the Isle of Wight. They did it originally because the poet laureate Lord Tennyson, Alfred Tennyson, lived next door. Julia Margaret Cameron, I suppose one of the greatest photographers certainly of the 19th century, came once to visit him with her children on holiday. They fell so in love with the place they built, they bought the house next door.
And I've actually learnt something today. I've been here a number of times sort of over the past few years. She actually bought a Dimbola Lodge as it is now, being one building. It was actually two cottages.
If you stand up, well, they call them cottages. By your standards and mine, they're quite big houses, aren't they?
Yes.
but she bought the two houses, and then actually we only learnt relatively recently, everyone's always said they built that tower in between and made them into one house. That was sort of 10 years later. So right. For a long time, she lived in one house, she rented out the other or let her friends stay there. And then in due course, she did two things. She built that tower, turned it into one house, and she built a building which no longer exists on the side of the house to be a sort of a place for amateur theatricals, and then also to take some bigger photographs and the ones that she used to take in the old converted greenhouse on the lawn.
And of course that's something of a theme in her work, is that they are very theatrical. I gather that her work was roughly speaking divided into two sort of areas as such. You've got the very sort of typical sort of very close portraits, but then you've got these sort of allegorical sort of illustrations of tell me about the sort of works that she was illustrating.
Through history she has always been hugely respected for the portraits, which are some of the greatest portraits of the 19th century. The art critic in the New York Times said she was the greatest portraitist in any medium in the 19th century. But she gradually grew more and more interested in theatrical subjects. Early on, she illustrated scenes from the Bible, right in the first weeks of her work. But in due course, I think particularly after she built that theatre in the grounds, people of that sort of class and culture loved amateur theatricals.
Yes, yeah.
Her son wanted to be a professional actor. Tennyson's son wanted to be a professional actor. The Tennysons absolutely forbade him for doing it. It was a rather shameful thing to be a professional. Henry Herschel Hay, the son, who was also a portrait photographer, did go on the London stage for a time. But towards the end, yes, she illustrated scenes from the Bible. She illustrated scenes from all kinds of English poetry, particularly, of course, of her great hero and next-door neighbour Tennyson. And actually the biggest project at the end of her time here, because she left here in 1874 and went to live in Ceylon for the last 5 years of her life, was to illustrate his hugely successful and popular Idylls of the King, all about King Arthur.
Yes,
and
yeah.
All those. And she published two books of those, two albums of those, which were very special and very rare. That took up a lot of her time. And traditionally,
critics over the years have disliked, they've dismissed them, say it's, you know, bad Victorian melodramatic stuff. When I did the big exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery in 2003, I showed roughly half the exhibition of those pictures. And I felt so pleased when the critics picked those out to praise them, or showed one of those as the illustrated picture rather than the conventional well-known portraits. Conventional well-known portraits are masterpieces, but we've seen them all before. And to open up her work in the same way, we showed as many pictures as anyone has ever shown. I've never been exhibited, as far as I know, in my lifetime, of the pictures she took at the end of her life in Ceylon, where the traditional view is to say, oh, these are snapshots of the natives and they're nothing like as good as... It's absolute nonsense. She gives them real dignity and power and humanity the way she does the maidservants here or the porter at Yarmouth Pier. You know, she was very good at making human beings dignified, whatever class and background they came from.
And you mentioned Ceylon there. Let's talk a little bit about sort of her sort of back history. I mean, she wasn't naturally drawn to photography from a very young age. I gather it was her family, immediate family, that gave her her first camera when she was, what, 50 or thereabouts?
She of course, when she was a young girl, there was no such thing as photography. She was living in India at the time. She was sent samples of the photography in the 1840s by her great friend Sir John Herschel. It was indeed when she was right here in this house in 1863, when she would have been 48, her daughter and son-in-law gave her a camera and saying, I won't get the exact words, but we hope this will amuse you, mother, while... Because her husband, Cameron, was the biggest landowner in Ceylon, what we now call Sri Lanka, and he was always going out to his coffee estates to look after them. By the way, I haven't made a slip of the tongue, it was then coffee, not tea, that was the big product. And it was really, she was a coffee widow with nothing to do, and they gave her this camera. Now, we think that she'd taken pictures of other people's cameras before.
Oh, right.
And she'd showed a particular interest in what happened in the darkroom and how you developed prints and so on and so forth. So there is a kind of back history there. Right. We have very firm piece of evidence that she used somebody's camera in 1857 to take pictures, but she finally got her own camera in just about Christmas 1863, and her first great triumph, which somewhere around us there's a reproduction of my first success, little girl called Annie Philpott.
Yeah. Yes.
In January 1864. And I was very lucky in researching years ago now, well before the last couple of books, I actually found the very first print that she'd made, still in the Philpott family. And stuck in the family album is the letter she sent. And the point about this letter is that she boasted that she did everything from mixing the chemicals, preparing the negative, taking the photograph, developing it, making a print, drying it, mounting it, and sending up to her little Annie's dad, who was staying with the Tennysons next door, and the whole process only took her 7 hours. She was pleased about that.
It's something that is almost sort of something of a theme throughout her work, as we maybe ought to have a little wander through
by
here.
By all means, if there's any picture you want to talk about.
I mean, as we're sort of walking through here, there is obviously a certain sort of, by today's standards, we're very used to images being very crisp and everything is about resolution now, of course, and what have you. There is a certain softness and a certain sort of genteel sort of quality. I think I'm right in saying that part of her process and the sort of the experimentations, although she could have had the images to be somewhat sharper, in fact she actually played with focus, played with softening the images to bring across her creative, her artistic sort of feelings.
I think that's actually right. The equipment that she first had meant that actually it would have been very hard to get some of these photographs totally in focus, because she didn't know, in fact, about the size of the plate and so on. It would have been very hard to get the right depth of field. But the fact is that, and she writes about this in her brief autobiography, you know, she would just turn the focus until it looked pictorially right.
Well, I mean,
she could get a whole picture in focus. There are pictures, and we happen to be standing in front of some of the Ceylon pictures, for instance, on where everything is very sharply in focus. The light was a bit brighter there, of course, but because of the chemistry and because of what she had, the other thing is she had enormously long exposure time.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, we don't know exactly, but we sort of think that our average exposure time was about 4 minutes. Okay, now you try and stand absolutely still without moving a muscle while I take your photograph for 4 minutes. Of course, you can't do it. It's physically impossible. So there's a slight blur, which is also people moving.
But she didn't use, often we see sort of neck braces or sort of struts of some sort. She didn't use that. So she was obviously very aware of people's comfort. And again, it's with any sort of photographic practice, you want to make your subjects as comfortable as possible.
Not Mrs. Cameron.
No.
No. She felt that... you got a much more dramatic effect by not doing that.
Okay.
The fact is that, I mean, if you look at, and I don't, it's probably somewhere near us, but we've got Thomas Carlyle, the great historian, founder of the National Portrait Gallery and so on, in profile where we're standing. There is a picture of him, full face, which for my money is one of the greatest portraits of the 19th century. And he's standing there looking really cross and angry and full of power. And you get this sense of this poor man being made to stand still for 4 minutes, this very bullying sort of bossy woman standing behind the camera, and you feel that they're really staring at each other, and there's a real sense of you get beneath the surface, that you've got something going on in that guy's brain for 4 minutes.
Was it quite typical for her almost to alienate her subjects in a sense?
No, I don't think she had a hatred of them. It wasn't like that. I think in our time, probably Richard Avedon did that a bit. I mean, he really set up a deliverer. You know, I don't think she did that, but I mean, she was so determined to get the right pictorial effect. She was so determined to say that actually, with photography, I can do what the Renaissance masters did with their religious paintings. I can make young women look as beautiful as Burne Jones. I can do portraits as good as G.F. Watts. She was determined to have photography measured alongside painting, and that meant the traditional thing about all being very sharp and all being in focus.
And she had a great liking for the pre-Raphaelite
imagery.
Absolutely
right.
And that's something...
You see some of them around you, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. Something like this image that's just in front of us here.
Mary Mother, Mary Hillier, her favourite maid, daughter of a shoemaker in a village down the road. She chose her maids as much as anything to see how beautiful they looked because they were favourite subjects. And yes, Mary Mother with this draped cloth round her head and so on is very much like Beato Beatrix or other paintings like Rossetti. And actually we've got both maids here together, haven't we? The beautiful Mary Ryan.
Yeah.
That's Mary Hillier. Mary Ryan is the gardener's daughter, a daughter of an Irish beggar maid who Cameron found begging on Putney Heath. Took her into her family as a very young teenager, as a maid, but had her brought up, taught by the governess, the same governess that taught Cameron's own children.
Oh, right.
And it's one of those really lovely romantic Victorian stories, because in due course her picture, probably this very one, but one of them, because she posed for a lot of pictures after the Italian great masters, Perugino, Giotto, people like that, was hanging in a London exhibition. A man called Henry Cotton, who was one of the English civil servants out in India, which of course is where the Cameron family came from too, saw the picture, fell in love with the image of the woman, came down here, wooed her, married her, and you know, the Camerons gave her jewellery, the Tennysons lent her a coach for the wedding and all that. In due course, Henry Cotton is made Sir Henry Cotton. So this Irish beggar girl is now Lady Cotton.
Wow, what a story.
That's not bad, is it?
So, I mean, were you just going back to this image of Mary here. Julia Margaret was very aware of having the right person to personify an image. If we just have a little wander through here, I happened to notice when I was looking around earlier, the picture here, the gentleman that is representing King Arthur.
I know, funny enough, it's exactly what we were thinking of, because of course you're right, he's King Arthur, a great hero of Arthurian legend and of Tennyson's Idylls of the King. And by the way, I keep seeing idylls, whereas most English people would say idylls, because I'm told that that's what Tennyson scholars call him, the Tennysonians call him idylls. He was actually the porter at Yarmouth Pier, where the steamer from Lymington comes in. And she took a lot of trouble spotting the right characters to play these Arthurian roles.
But she was not averse to bringing her own husband in.
Oh, no.
It's very majestic in his, like you say, King Lear picture.
He had wonderful, wonderful long grey hair. No, he plays King Lear in the Arthurian story. He's Merlin in Vivian and Merlin. No, he often gets dragged into it.
And, of course, he was 20 years her senior.
He was.
Interesting though, he slightly outlived her.
Yes.
Whereas normally, yes, of course, even today, women tend to last a bit longer than fellows. Mm. And I think, this is my mere speculation, but you know, somebody who spent so much of their life in a dark room with all those awful chemicals,
yes,
I've no doubt whatsoever that it knocked a few years off her life.
But she actually, the time of her death, they were actually back in Ceylon, I gather.
They were. They went back there 5 years before she died. In 1974 they went there, she died in 1879.
And I gather that there's not, by comparison, there's not a lot of her imagery actually survives from that, sort of the years that they were over there.
No, and I had not until a few years ago ever seen more than two or three, and there are copies of two or three here which are in the Royal Photographic Society collection. But first of all, while I was running the National Museum in Bradford, I was extraordinarily lucky. An artist I knew had actually inherited a number of the Solanese pictures, and we bought them for the museum. So the National Museum, what now called the National Media Museum, has the biggest collection of any of them anywhere in the world. But when I did the big show, which I've already mentioned, which toured and finished up in Los Angeles, we showed every single one of the 13 or 14 Ceylon pictures that survive, and they'd never been exhibited in my lifetime, certainly, and they looked terrific, I thought.
And is there a reason why they haven't survived? Is there a...
Think about the climate of Ceylon or Sri Lanka. Very hot, very wet. Exactly the wrong conditions to preserve photographs.
Yes.
I'm always hoping that a few more will survive, but on the whole, the ones that survive were obviously the ones that were sent back to England.
But it's not unusual for these old sort of great pictures to be dug up. I mean, we've had in recent years Robert Capa, a load of his work that was found in someone's attic
in
something?
Mexico, yeah. In a suitcase, and I saw that actual suitcase and had my hands on it not 2 months ago, and I'm very much hoping that when I do the big Hungarian exhibition at the Royal Academy, that suitcase will be in the showcase. Because when they opened it, it's full of those little reels of 35.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very silly thing to say, but you almost want to cry when you feel that contact with something long ago.
I mean, I can tell, obviously, it's very clear probably to everyone listening, you're very passionate, not just about imagery and photography and Julia Margaret Cameron, but also the great pictures or the heritage should be preserved. That's why Dimbola is here for people
Such
to see
an
and
important
to
thing,
appreciate.
Yes. And to get a real sense of what it was like to be there, what life was like then, what an important part photography played, but also we're in the presence of a real pioneer, somebody, you know, you talked about these being the close-up portraits. I once did a BBC programme where we called them the world's first close-ups, and in a way they were.
Mm. And it's something that has influenced more modern-day practitioners. People obviously most likely would be aware of Bailey and what have you. But, you know, people that he influenced, people like Rankin, for example, you can see, if you trace it, you can actually see the influences coming through.
A lot of people have seen the work of Julia Margaret Cameron, there's no question. And there's a photograph, I think it only exists here, it's on the front cover of my book in the shop, but I think it only exists hanging on the wall in that stereo, lenticular stereo, which is hanging in the restaurant where somebody did this wonderful picture of Iago, who's an Italian professional model, changing into the mountain named Sweet Liberty. There's this picture of Iago, head and shoulders, very dramatically lit. When we did the BBC programme, a postcard of that was just on the bookcase over the director's desk, and she says that every woman who walked past said, "Who's that?" And I mean, it's a picture that could have been taken last week, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so modern.
Obviously about giving people a sense of the time, the period, the settings. Let's have a little wander, because there's, as well as the imagery...
Are we going to Julia's bedroom?
I think that would be a lovely place to head. So, obviously we're walking through here and we've got all these images around that are sort of have their own importance in various ways. But there are rooms that are recreated in the way that they would have been in terms of, like you say, the bedroom. So tell me a little bit about this. We're just sort of heading down the steps now into this other section. And the first thing we see here as we turn the corner is the bed under the archway.
Yes, I mean, the trustees here, and of course it's a museum run by volunteers who've done wonderful work, done their very best to get back to what they think it might have been like.
Sometimes they found examples of wallpaper. Here's the William Morris wallpaper, which, you know, they found a scrap of and were able to get more of. They've tried to go back to the right colours. They've tried to have the right kind of furniture. I think the only sad thing is, as I look out of Julia's bedroom window, I can see a bungalow about 20 yes. feet away. And when I first saw this house, that bungalow wasn't here.
Right.
And I suppose in the long term, the last thing I want to do is threaten the people who live there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the long term planning for this, wouldn't it be wonderful to gradually take those over, buy them, get rid of them and restore the garden, because they loved the grounds. Mm. Her first glass house was somewhere out where that bungalow
yes.
is. One would love to get some sense of that. One would like to put her amateur, it was called Mrs. Cameron's Thatched House Theatre. Wouldn't it be wonderful to bring that back, use it as a lecture theatre, use it as a performance area? But, you know, we're talking about a few decades of development.
Yeah. But even in the sort of the immediate vicinity in the building itself, yeah. I was just reading that we've got some literature in
yep.
front of us here.
Yep. You've probably read it more recently than I have.
Yes,
yeah.
I had before we began our chat, I just
yep.
had a quick look. Now, this is as close as, given the confines, as we can see it would have been, down to the linen and what have you.
Yep.
But it does mention here about the bedside cabinet and so forth. There's a reference here that you know for a fact that Julia Margaret actually had her bed under the archway that's just above.
There are some pieces of evidence, I think. You've read it more recently than me, so you're more of the expert on the placing of the bed than I am, probably. We do know about where some of the things are placed. I know, and I haven't been able to get back to it. Back in the 70s, I found someone who still had Mrs. Cameron's piano. Someone has got Mrs. Cameron's letterpress, and I've just discovered this year someone who has her day bed.
Wow.
And of course, I shall work on seeing what I can do about getting some of those things back here. But we are in a real Victorian bedroom, aren't we?
Mm.
And it does have a real sense of character, and I think that's the challenge of somewhere like this, is to get the real historic sense and to take the visitor back to the 1860s and 70s, which is when we're talking about, but also, of course, to show, not only to show exhibitions of photographs of people of that time and since, but actually to show some of the best modern work, because, you know, she was at the cutting edge, and she would respect the fact that we find people at the cutting edge of photography now. And we should show them now. And one of the things, you happen to come at a wonderful moment, in a sense, because for the first time since it's opened, we've been able to put in a very high class lighting system and a very professional hanging system, and to adjust the colour scheme in the galleries and so on. And suddenly they look like really, really good modern picture galleries
yes.
in this Victorian house. And I think that's fantastic. It's a great moment, and it's exactly the right thing to do.
And you've also got an area that I understand is known as the Olympus Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Let's have a little wander sort of down there, because as I've been here sort of this morning, I've been sort of filming and having a chat with you, the preparations for this. Tell me a bit about what's actually going on, what this area is, and sort of what it's designed to do.
Well, this is the place where we do changing photography exhibitions, and it can be anything. As I say, it can be a historic photographers, it can be contemporary photographers. Here we're dealing with today's exhibition is of photographs that have, in some cases, been taken this year. And that, as I say, I think it's absolutely right. Mrs. Cameron would have respected this. One of the reasons that this particular exhibition has been chosen to be here is the photographs are of many different races and you know, there are Muslims, there are Arabs, there are natives of different African countries and so on. And that, in a way, seems to be right for the house of a woman who, after Julia Margaret Cameron had Indian blood.
Yes.
She used to talk to her sisters when she didn't want anyone else to know what it was about. They'd all talk in Hindustani, so the rest of us wouldn't have a clue what was going on. She photographed an Ethiopian here. We've already talked about the fact that when she was in Sri Lanka, she photographed the Tamils. So I think she would respect the fact that here is this particular photography is a white Jewish woman who has enormous respect for and works very closely with and has really integrated herself into these different communities all over, particularly Africa, but also in Vietnam and Thailand and places like that. And I think the fact, what's the other thing that's close to Mrs. Cameron? They're all very close up, or a lot of them are. You get this real sense of what I said before, seeing beneath the skin. This is not some sort of tourist snapper catching the odd native in an ethnic way as you pass by. This is someone who's really worked hard at integrating herself into these communities, getting to know the people, working and living with them for a time. And I just think, you know, given the fault lines of society today and the fact that, you know, it seems to be that we're back to the Crusades almost in all the way that different races and religions mistrust and even hate each other. This is not just great photography. It's actually it's saying we're all the same, really, and we should all respect each other and all our different practices and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, if we just sort of wander through here... We've already alluded to the fact that Mrs. Cameron had the likes of Tennyson, Darwin, for example, sort of personal family friends. She was very well established with a certain level of person. The people that we see around the walls here are, I'm right in thinking, your average for their...
we're not dealing with aristocrats or famous people at all. No.
But there is, I mean, this picture here, we've got a black and white image of a lady, and I assume to be her son and a bowl here. It's a very sympathetic shot. The light is very graphic, but it is all about the lady and her child.
Absolutely.
Which goes back to some of the images that we were seeing in the main
apart from
there.
A few of the theatrical pictures, the majority of Cameron's pictures, there's no background that you're aware of. She didn't even, unlike Nurit Yardeni, who we're looking at now, Mrs. Cameron didn't even want the clothes to take anything away from the face. So, you know, she'd look at you in your blue sweatshirt and she'd drape you in a black velvet robe, wouldn't she, to make sure it didn't distract from anything. Here we get a bit more sense of background, but on the whole, what Nurit Yardeni is interested in is the face, the character, and what lies behind it. And I think she captures it. You almost feel that you've met these people, don't you? That you've been to these exotic places. And I find that very exciting.
And the scale of the faces here, a great majority of the pictures there, they are life-size or
just
larger.
Just about life-size.
Just about.
And so we very deliberately did very big prints for that reason. Because again, it's very hard for us to think ourselves back to the 1860s, isn't it? But most people, when they saw a Mrs. Cameron photograph, had never seen a life-size photograph before. The fact that the head on the piece of paper is just about the same size as a real head, that must have been quite powerful. If you think about the images that they mostly knew, they were carte de visite.
Yes.
You know, 4 1/4 inches high. The face in most, you know, usually full length. So the face is about the size of your little fingernail. You're not going to learn much about character
quite.
From that, are you? So the drama of what Cameron changed is so powerful, hard for us to recapture. But I think doing these big prints like this does get some of that feeling. That's why we very consciously said we wanted, even though these are relatively small rooms, we wanted really big pictures so they came out and you did have that sense of being life-size, and sometimes more than life-size, aren't they?
And what do you think Julia would have made of the colour? Because, of course...
Well, of course, she didn't know about colour.
No.
Colour didn't exist. But, she would have embraced it, wouldn't she? She was out front there. If she'd have had the chance of doing colour, she would have done it, don't you think? I think so. What she didn't do, of course, are the people who, before colour photography existed, what a lot of people did was had them hand-coloured. She didn't do that. She would have thought that was cheating. She always boasted that one of the reasons that artists like her work is that, unlike professionals, she never retouched anything. It's not quite true. There are one or two pictures, but I mean, we're talking about one or two among hundreds, where there is a clear retouching. And she often found, and Lewis Carroll had the same problem, that, for instance, feet looked too big somehow.
Yes.
She couldn't make those. So she tried to do that. There was a picture where she wanted a halo behind the saint, so she painted it in. There's a picture with a moon in the background. But, you know, they are few and far between. If there was a blemish on one's face, she wouldn't retouch that. She thought that was dishonest, and she would have thought, I think she would have thought hand colouring was dishonest.
And so this raises perhaps the issue, and people are often familiar with the phrase that the camera never lies.
Oh, no.
You
the
know.
Camera always lies. We
exactly.
Know that. You and
people,
I know that.
People think it's a very modern thing with the digital age, but it's been going on since the dawn
of
photography.
Course.
Absolutely
right.
It's too
easy now, I think. I think that's probably true. And you know that. Photographs in newspapers have nearly always been digitally retouched in some way or another, and it certainly when I founded the National Museum, you know, we had a few sort of basic rules. And one of them is, I said, you know, the subtext of everything we're doing is the camera always lies.
Yes, yeah. It's interesting to see these modern pictures alongside almost the older pictures here. I thank you for your time today.
It's pleasure.
Been fascinating for me with my vested interest, but I'm sure those listening will have gained a little better understanding. I'm going to be giving out the information about how visitors can come and see Dimbola Lodge, which is down freshwater, down on the Isle of Wight here. Are there any parting words, anything that you would pass on to people to encourage them to come in here or anything?
I think if you're seriously interested in photography, you cannot ignore not the only home of photographer that's open to the public in this great photographer genius open to the public, but actually the only one of a photographer of this kind of stature anywhere in Britain, certainly, and perhaps in the world. If you're interested in photography, you ought to be looking at its history, and this is the place where you get closer to that, the sort of lifeblood of what was happening 160 years ago than anywhere else in Britain. So please come.
Thank you very much, Colin.
Pleasure.
There's always something new going on at Dimbola, so be sure to check out their website for all the latest exhibitions, news and events. You can check out all the show notes to this and other week's shows at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, of course, I'm on Twitter at Giles Babbage. You can check out my Facebook page, Giles Babbage Photography. Or, of course, send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@theactivephotographer.com. So thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, have a great week, and I will speak to you all very soon.